Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, today we're going to spend our couple of hours zeroing in on Norway. And to begin, we're talking about a new book. It's titled Mission to Oslo, Dancing with the Queen, Deal Making with the Russians, Shaping History. And the author, Tom Loftus, is with us. He's the former U.S. ambassador to Norway. He served 14 years in our state legislature. It was four terms as Speaker of the Wisconsin Assembly, ran for governor at one point, and is from Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. So as we talk with Tom, I hope you'll join in with your own questions, maybe about the role of an ambassador, and certainly about Norway. Maybe you visited the country. Let us know your questions and maybe experiences about Norway, or maybe about international diplomacy. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Tom Loftus, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Larry. Thanks for having me. I have to add that I'm a regular listener to your garden show.
Well, that's good. That is good to know, and I appreciate that. You've had your book, by the way. I really enjoyed your book. I'm a guy who kind of likes history, and I like behind the scenes kinds of things relating to history. I like a little humor. And I like to learn about a country. So all that came through in your book. So thanks for writing it to begin with. You must have had fun putting it together.
Well, yeah, 4 years to write the book and another year or two to finish it for publishing. But it was a delight to write. You are correct.
And I enjoyed right away in the beginning of the book, you talk about the materials you used to put your book together. Tell us about that.
Well, how does one write a memoir 30 years after the fact? Well, I left Norway and had 10 boxes of personal papers shipped home. I never opened them until 5 years ago. And lo and behold, there was my daily schedule, which is an hour-by-hour schedule, for all 1,461 days I was in Norway as the ambassador. So that raw material wasn't only the schedules. It was the guests, Jimmy Carter. It was the dinners, Tommy Thompson. It was the menus for the dinners. It was my travel schedule that when I reread the book before publication, I got tired. I really was on the road both in Norway and in Europe. So that's how it came about, that raw material just presented itself, and it was a joy to write.
Let's talk about the relationship between Wisconsin and Norway. We kind of influenced each other, I think, in some ways.
Well, in many ways, of course, we can start with the 800,000 Norwegian immigrants that came over a period of time, starting in 1825, and that was about 40% of the population of Norway. And they came to Wisconsin, Illinois, the Dakotas, and Minnesota. It was called a rural-to-rural immigration because they came from farms and they settled in farm communities. But the largest concentration of Norwegians, 50,000, was in Chicago, in the Humboldt Park area. And that was the largest concentration of Norwegians outside of Oslo and Bergen.
And
you have that as a starter, And then you have some little details that young Norwegian men were paid a bonus to come to Wisconsin to fight for the Union Army. And the Wisconsin division, headed by Hans Christian Hegg, was a very important part of the immigration story.
Yeah. And you have, obviously, familial ties to Norway. Maybe describe that for us.
Well, my grandfather, as a young boy, came with his family, nine children, left Telemark, Norway, came, and eventually ended up in Dane County, Wisconsin. They left on July 4th, 1885, and settled in the Oregon, Brooklyn, and Stoughton area eventually. I went to this farm in Telemark, and I knocked on the door, and sure enough, the people were named Lofthus. It was L-O-F-T-H-U-S. So my family name means loft house. In all, it means they left a farm that had a house that had a loft. So that name of the farm was very common for Norwegian immigrants. Now, the H was dropped when they got to America. And Telemark is sort of the... I'd say card playing, drink some once in a while, fiddle playing. It's we're almost pagan part of Norway. My grandmother came from the Stavanger area. This is the Bible Belt of Norway, and no card playing, no dancing, no fun, no nothing. How these two would have never met in Norway.
Oh.
And this is part of the American dream, of course, that there they are. And I inherited that Telemark part of the gene.
Oh, man. Well, I want to switch to ambassadors for a minute. How long has the U.S. had ambassadors stationed around the world?
Well, Ben Franklin was the first.
Yeah.
During the Revolutionary War, he was in Paris, and his job was to enlist the French on behalf of America against the British. Thomas Jefferson was a subsequent ambassador to France. And we have John Adams as an ambassador in the Netherlands. So it's been as long as we have been a country. Now, Norway has only been an independent country since 1905. So our ambassadors start then. And during World War One. Woodrow Wilson's ambassador was Alfred Schmiedren from Wisconsin, who later became the mayor of Madison and the governor of the state. That's a thumbnail sketch there.
And you've kind of implied some of the duties of an ambassador, but maybe you could talk about, you know, when you were an ambassador, what were the prime duties? And your prime duties, I'm sure, were quite in many respects, quite similar to the rest of the ambassadors.
Well, when you are an ambassador to a country, that means the president has nominated you and the Senate has voted on you, and you become an ambassador to a country. And you're called an ambassador plenipotentiary, which means that you can act on behalf of the president. Yes, the State Department is the superstructure, and that's where most of the business is. But it's quite an important job, and the American ambassador in any country is the main person. Of the diplomatic corps, And I had an occasion to act on behalf of the president without his knowledge. The Nobel Peace Prize is given in Oslo. And one day I am waiting in my office to go to the city hall for the Peace Prize ceremony for Nelson Mandela. And an hour before, I get a phone call. My assistant says, I think you'll want to take this call. And it was Nelson Mandela. And he said, thank you, Mr. Ambassador, for taking my call. Could you be in my hotel suite, the Grand Hotel, 1 hour after the Nobel Prize ceremony? And I said, of course. Now, I had not a clue what this was about. Well, I was there. I go into the room, and honest to goodness, there is an aura. There is almost a goodness in the air. And we shake hands. His hands are very soft. He pours me tea, and I take milk, and he takes milk. Well, this is about a tariff issue, that the United States is proposing a tariff at some negotiations at this time for South Africa. And Mandela will be the new president of the new South Africa in about 6 months' time. And he said, if this U.S. tariff that you're proposing goes through, I'll lose 200,000 jobs in the textile, which is basically the clothing. So here is the plenipotentiary part. There's a secret number for ambassadors, and it's a special White House operator. So I call and I said, I need the trade negotiator on the phone within 10 minutes if possible. And I knew him. His name was Mickey Cantor. So he gets on the phone and I say, Mickey, I'm in the hotel suite in Oslo with Nelson Mandela. He has just received the Nobel Peace Prize, and he wants us to change our position on tariffs. And I said we would. Here, I'll put him on the phone. Well, okay, so Mickey said, well, you'll be back there 24 hours from now, and I'll call you. So I was back with Mr. Mandela. Mickey called, and he said, yes, we'll do it, but Mr. Mandela cannot tell anybody, and we'll just do it. So I quickly wrote a note to the president not to fire the trade representative and that this was my doing, and I said, Nelson Mandela owes you a big one. So that's an example, and an American ambassador and the residence of the ambassador is not only represents the president, but the United States and all Americans.
Yeah. Tom Loftus, our guest today. Tom's book, which you're going to enjoy, A Mission to Oslo, and the subtitle, Dancing with the Queen, Deal-Making with the Russians, Shaping History. Questions or comments for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today as we talk about Norway in a couple of shows. A little later on at noon, we'll hear the continued story of Norwegian immigration to the U.S. and the impact Norwegians have had on our state's culture. Right now, Tom Loftus, a former U.S. ambassador to Norway, a Sun Prairie, Wisconsin native, is talking about his book, Mission to Oslo, a wonderful book about his time there. You know, I want to go back to, Tom, to the story of how Bill Clinton, President Clinton, selected you as ambassador. And then I certainly want to talk about preparations and the kids and the family and so forth. But what about that process about being selected?
Well, Larry, I was one of the very few speakers in legislatures in America that ever got involved in presidential primaries. And there's a reason for that. You pick a candidate and you make ingrates of the other people running. But I was always involved. I started with Morris Udall in the primary in Wisconsin and went through Mondale and was the chairman of the Dukakis for President campaign. And I was the top-ranking Democrat in the state at this time. And in 1992, I had come to know Bill Clinton and chaired his campaign in Wisconsin. And he won. It was a very difficult race because the Democrats are a party that whoever the nominee is going to be, we have a faction that doesn't want that nominee. But anyway, so we were close, and I was in the parking garage of the Milwaukee Area Technical School. This was one of the last campaign events. Clinton had a Harley Davidson jacket on. Their Harleys are made in Milwaukee. And I said to him, if you get elected president, I am going with you. And I didn't say I'd like to. I said I was. And that's how close we were. So February 1993, I'm in the Oval Office with the president, just the two of us. He's only been president for a month. And we say to each other, this is amazing that we're here in this office. This is amazing. And he said, well, here's where Nixon kept the secret tape recorder. Here's my desk. This is the Resolute desk, a gift from Queen Victoria. And I said to him, I want to be appointed ambassador to Norway. Well, he had been briefed that this was coming, and he said to me, you'd be good at that. Well, politicians, seasoned politicians, never want to say no, and they'd like to imply an answer that meant yes. Well, that wasn't a no, and weeks went by, and nothing happened. Well, one of the staff people that I knew went to look at my file and knew exactly what had happened. Clinton had wretched handwriting. And one staff person had read his note as no, a bad idea. But what he had written was not a bad idea. So my nomination went forward. And, the vetting, the State Department, then the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, four of us going to Europe, had our hearing. Herb Kohl introduced me, and we were reported out unanimously, and then nothing. And more weeks. And a senator, and senators can do this under their custom, was holding us four hostage. This senator wanted someone in the State Department fired. I had never heard of this senator, Mitch McConnell. Well, a deal was made. They weren't fired, but some deal was made. And so we off to Norway and off to our small three-story Art Nouveau villa sitting on its own city block.
It was quite an operation. And you had to, you and the wife and kids had to go through a little training, I would assume. And Norwegian isn't the easiest language to learn. You knew a little of it. I think wasn't your wife pretty fluent?
Well, after. This is after the fact, yeah. Well, the State Department allowed me to take my initial Norwegian lessons in Wisconsin rather than going to Washington and studying at the Language Institute. There is a Language Institute not only for State Department people, but also for the military, because the attachés around the world and others usually will learn the language. So my tutor was Lou Ann Sorensen, and she was a graduate student at the Scandinavian Studies Department at the UW. By the way, they're having their 150th anniversary. And Lou Ann said, you know, at age 48, you're not going to be very good at this at all, but we're going to work on your accent. And she was right. The most important thing is if you've got the right accent, so people understand you really made an effort, that will do you well. And then we had a tutor in the embassy itself for the staff. This was basically a consultant. And I had Norwegian lessons there. And it was mostly, he also said, you're not going to be very good speaking this language, but we're going to get you so you can read and you can do diplomatic talk. You can say the right things with the right accent. And I accomplished that. And I gave a 4th of July speech every year in Norwegian, practice it, as you can imagine. The tutor took out every word that I had trouble pronouncing, and we got it down to a point. And the first time I gave this speech, people came up afterwards. We didn't know you were fluent in Norwegian. So I got quite a reputation for that, but that's that story. I couldn't. When I go to Norway, it comes back, and when I'm here, I can read it, but that's about it. And learning a language at age 48 is not recommended, but I did my best.
Well, I think you did pretty darn well. I was taken by the you had a comment about the difference and the kids, your kids, and what was different about Norwegian schools compared to American schools.
Well, Norwegian schools are they start at a very early age, let's say 3 or 4, in what we would call a preschool. But there they call it a barnehagen. Barna is the word for children. Hagen is the word for garden. And these are sort of play, learn centers that are mostly outside, including in the winter. And at age 7, they start school, go to age 19. And the big difference is that last year is like the first year of college. The other difference is Norwegians are taught English as their other first language. It's not taught as a second language or a foreign language, because there's only 5 million people. They have to speak English in their daily lives, their studies, the textbooks, the thing. The third difference is the Lutheran Church was the state religion of Norway when I was there, headed by the king. The bishop and the pastors were government employees. The religious teaching takes place in the public schools, not in the churches. So it took me a while to really get my bearings as to my relationship with the official church. I got around it. I got to it, but that was quite different than me growing up a Lutheran at the Bristol Lutheran Church outside Sun Prairie, or on being baptized at the Liberty Lutheran Church in Deerfield. I could do a whole book on that subject alone, but that's the answer to your question.
And the kids had to learn to cross-country ski, of course.
Oh, God, yes. and I did. You know, I had my colleague in Finland, he had to take a nude saunas. all I had to do was go cross-country skiing, which was a social occasion. And my youngest son, Carl, he was 6 or 7 at this time. He was in school. And they took him away for a week to learn how to cross-country ski at a camp. This is what it was. Now, after the end of the Cold War, the NATO base in Oslo, which had 5,000 personnel, most of them administrative, closed. I closed it. And then an international school opened. The British school, the Pentagon school, the Department of Defense school, and a small international school merged. So the boys had that experience. And you had to have a language in that school, and it couldn't be Norwegian. Now, there were a lot of Norwegian students who had their own studies. So it had to be an international language. And that was a great experience, and has stood them well.
You mentioned in passing the residence, and there are so many other stories, and we'll get to them. But the residence itself, that was a site for meetings, but a lot of social occasions. So it was a large. Talk about that for a minute.
Well, it's a large house, 3.5 acres of gardens and a park. It sits on its own city block. It's a historic Art Nouveau style house. It was bought by the State Department in 1923 for $125,000, the best property the State Department owns in the world. And the reason the residents, we could sit 50 people for dinner. The secret are round tables, and taking out the furniture.
Yeah.
But, under the State Department metric, Oslo was the costliest city in the world to live. So my salary and others in the embassy were bumped up 35% to make it the difference. However, we couldn't entertain in restaurants or hire halls or do anything like that. It was just too expensive. So we did all of the entertaining and the meetings, mostly in the ambassador's residence. And, there were 3 maids, there was a chef, a gardener, a police, former policeman for security, my driver, and my car. Started out with an armored Cadillac, ended up with a black Impala V8 engine, cloth seats, no armor. All of that, plus the seating charts and everything, that's the canvas. It's as important as the canvas to an artist. This is where the work is done. You go there to be a professional friend, and it involves meals. And when people sit down with each other, you become acquaintances, then you become friends, and then former adversaries start to smile, and you can get some work done.
Yeah. It's a fantastically interesting story. Cheryl in Iron Ridge has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I am 50% Norwegian. My grandmother and grandfather were from Oslo and Trondheim. And I also belong to the Sons of Norway. But the question I have for you is, I have always wanted to go there and see it. And I'm 72 now. And what would you recommend me to go see first, and how to see Norway first for my very first time to go there?
Well, first of all, I'm 80, so I don't think you're very old at all. Well, we had this question about every day of those 1,400 days. I had this question, my assistant really came up with a boilerplate thing, and it was called Norway in a Nutshell, that if you have a little time, you go to Oslo, you take the train to Flam, you take the ship on the famous Sognefjord, you go to Bergen, and then you can go on from there, or you fly back to Oslo. It's very easy. All Norwegians speak English. And if you smile at them, they'll smile at you. It doesn't work the other way. So I would consider that. And also these cruises that where your hotel room is your ship, those are very popular, and they're popular for a reason, because they organize the things that you should see, rather than you trying to do it yourself. That's my answer to that.
Cheryl, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. I want to talk about Russia for a minute with you. It's hard to remember the state of Russia, the state that Russia was in when you were ambassador. And Norway was kind of key because, and for one thing, it's the only NATO member with a border with Russia. So you had a lot of focus on Russia.
I did. This period is the Cold War has ended. The Soviet Union has disappeared. Russia is a new and very shaky democracy headed by President Boris Yeltsin. The border with the Soviet Union and Norway is now a border with Russia and Norway. And Norway and the United States really need to use this entry point to build a new relationship with the new Russia. And why it is so important is that this part of Russia near at the city of Murmansk is the only ice-free port Russia has ever had on the Atlantic Ocean. So this is where all the nuclear-powered submarines are with their missiles in them aimed at the United States. And this is where all of the nuclear waste and used nuclear weapons are. This is also where the American submarines play cat and mouse with the Russian submarines under the polar ice cap. So my task was to form this new relationship with the Norwegians and partnership to build this new relationship with Russia, which meant cross-border trade and new customs and tourism and everything that you can imagine. So I'll just mention why. When Nazi Germany invaded Norway in a surprise invasion and the occupation followed, where Hitler had 350,000 troops in Norway, it was a very harsh occupation. Near the end of the war, the Soviet Red Army liberated North Norway from Nazi Germany, from the German soldiers. Well, instead of staying there, like the Soviet Union did in Eastern Europe, they just went back over the border and closed it, and it never opened for 50 years. And so I was one of the first to go over that border and went to Murmansk to deal with the Russian Northern Fleet officers and the head of the nuclear icebreaker fleet and we negotiated a deal on the safekeeping and secure storage of what is called low-level liquid radioactive waste. Larry, this is the liquid that cools reactors in a submarine, like a like in your car, mm-hmm. your radiator.
Yep.
And that becomes contaminated. The Russians were dumping it in the Arctic Ocean. So when I led this deal, it is a deal, that there would be safe storage of this and that there would be some U.S. help with the payments. And this was when there we had a deal with the Russians to help them deconstruct their nuclear weapons and safely secure the ones that were in outside of Russia proper. So that was a lot of trips to Russia, and it was the most important thing I did there. That is still ongoing. That was one thing that survived Putin so far.
So far. I remember you tell an interesting story about the new Russian ambassador visiting about the low-level nuclear waste into the Bering Sea.
Yeah. Well, I had, of course, you have to be friends.
Yeah.
And the new Russian, the Russian ambassador and I decided we were going to have lunch every month, just the two of us. His house one time, my house the next time. And we were going to tell each other things so there was no surprises. And I wasn't going to do something that would embarrass him in Russia, or he wasn't going to do something vice versa. And our first meeting was in my residence, that small house I described. And, you know, Russia was in tough shape at this point. They couldn't pay the sailors in the Northern Fleet. They were selling blood to get money. It was, the whole country was in very bad shape. The Russian embassy in Oslo, they could only fill their cars halfway up with gas before, you know, they waited for the next payment. Anyway, they survived. So we have this first lunch at my residence, and we really hit it off. And as we're leaving, I offhandedly say to him, "I suppose you have this place bugged." And he says, "Yes, but they don't work."
Oh, man.
It was his way of saying just everything has gone to pieces, including this.
Russia in a shambles. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Tom Loftus, our guest today, his book, a fascinating book, is titled Mission to Oslo, Dancing with the Queen, Deal-Making with the Russians, Shaping History. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tom Loftus, our guest today, former ambassador to Norway. We're talking about his book, Mission to Oslo. Very entertaining and interesting book. Esty in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Esty.
Hey, so I visited Norway twice. What a wonderful country, and did all kinds of amazing things, including crossing the Arctic Circle with the ceremony that goes with that, and sitting on the deck of a ferry on June 21st so that they could see the sun setting all the way and then coming right back up. And also visiting Kirkenes, which is on the border with Russia, and standing so close to the Russian soldiers, almost eye to eye, and being warned not to make another step because they would arrest us. But so that's just a few of many wonderful experiences. But I wanted to talk about two things that happened each in the one visit, but they are related in my mind. the first time I was traveling there with my mother, and we were visiting an old friend of hers in Oslo, and she took us all over the city and showed us and explained what we were seeing, and she took us to one of the neighborhoods that really didn't look different from any of the others, very wooded and nice and calm and clean. And she explained that this is a neighborhood where a lot of people who are addicted to drugs were living, that the government was providing them with small apartments, and there were clinics right there to exchange syringes and so on, and they were getting a small monthly
stipend. Stipend, I'll bet. Yeah. Well, Tom, a comment on that?
Yes. Norway, particularly Oslo, has had a terrific problem with heroin addiction, and not any more than any large city in America, to tell you the truth. But they had, their treatment was to try to prevent the addicts from doing petty crime and other things in order to feed their habits. So there was this needle exchange, which was important because use a dirty needle and you end up with anything from HIV/AIDS to tuberculosis. So that's what he's referring to. You know, very popular are Nordic murder mysteries in Wisconsin, in the United States.
They are.
You'll find this theme in a lot of them.
Yeah, yeah. Esty, thanks for those comments. Appreciate it. There were one story you tell illustrates the amount of planning and work that has to go into visits. And Hillary, who was the first lady at the time, came to the 1994 Olympics. And I was just struck at the amount of detail that has to go into planning for a visit from an important person.
Well, yes. Jimmy Carter came three times. I had the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. One important visitor after another. But the Lillehammer Olympics, the First Lady came, and we were friends before this, and we didn't have much notice, as you'll see in the book. We were told 10 days before the Olympics that the First Lady and 800 of her closest media friends would be descending on us, and Chelsea Clinton, who was 12 at the time. Well, we found a hotel room. It was in a legal fight in Sweden between heirs as to the ownership, and it was empty. A miracle, basically. And I called the lawyers and made a deal. They couldn't refuse. And so we took over that hotel for the period of the Olympics. Those Olympics were magical. And we had Tommy Moe, the American, won the downhill gold medal. And Dave Jansen from West Dallas won the gold medal in the speed skating after he fell down the first time. It was so amazing, and there was a person in the official delegation. It was me, Hillary, and then four or five others that the president has chosen. And he was the editor or the publisher of the Nashville Banner, and his name was Kirby Simpson Jr. II. It was a name right out of Mark Twain. Anyway, we're there at the VIP bleachers sitting, and a whisper goes up in the crowd that there is the king. And there's quite an audible whisper. before I could do anything, Mr. Kirby Simpson Jr. the second bolts from his seat and goes up to the man and said, King, this is the most wonderful Olympics. This is terrific. You should be so proud of the organization. The people are so helpful. The wonderful. This is great. And the man said, well, thank you very much, but I'm the king of Spain.
There's one other story I want you to tell, and that has to do with Tommy Thompson. He calls you from Germany.
Well, Tommy Thompson and I had been friendly adversaries in the legislature for 14 years, and or no, more than that. And, you know, we had this brief period when, as he describes it, I ran against him for governor. I said, Tommy, no, I ran for governor. So we were friends and always had been. So he calls me, and again, my assistant says, you'll want to take this call. And he said, Tom, it's Tommy. I'm in Germany, and I got nothing to do here. I'm going to come up there, okay? I said, okay. By the time you get up here, I'll find something for you to do. Turns out there were four states that were being considered for a wood flooring factory, a Norwegian company. And so, okay, we had a dinner. We took out all the furniture. We invited the whole management and the CEO and the spouses of everybody of this company. And I served reindeer. This when you serve reindeer, it's a fillet. This is the most a delicacy. Then you know that the guest is important. The guests know the guest is important. Tommy, I think, didn't understand why we're eating reindeer. Anyway, so we come, the meal is great. I hired a piano player. I went all out for him. Anyway, at the end of the meal, the Norwegian custom is to give a thank you for the food speech. Duck for Matten, it's called. The dessert was already on the table. Tommy gets up to give this speech. It's not supposed to be a speech. It's supposed to be a thank you for the food. And he recognizes his best friend ever in the world, Tom Loftus. I said, I don't know about that. Anyway, then he talks about the business acumen of the head of this company, and then the vivacity of his vivaciousness of his wife, and everyone in the audience, and he's going on and on and on. Well, the ice cream had melted. Yeah, and he was still going on about Wisconsin. You know, it was like Athens in the age of Pericles. It was Valhalla. It was, you know, whatever. Well, it turned out the company settled on a location in Racine. So there you have it.
Oh, my goodness. I wish we had more time to talk, Tom. This has been such a delight, and I'm telling you, it was a delight to read your book. I really, really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. Well, thank you so much for your service to Wisconsin and to the United States as well. And thanks for writing this book, and I hope a lot of people read it. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Larry.
Tom Loftus, his book, Mission to Oslo, and it's been chosen as one of three finalists for Best Memoir Autobiography of Midwest by Midwest Independent Publishers Association. So you're gonna have some fun reading it. We didn't get to even a 100th of the stories in his book. Well, we're going to continue our discussion about Norway, and that's coming up next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. So, a little Norwegian music, is it? I think it is a little Norwegian music to get us going here as we talk about Norwegian heritage on this show. And that's what you're going to hear. You're going to hear the history of Norwegian immigration to Wisconsin. Plus, we'll cover some genealogical research with our two guests. One of them, Jerry Grittenholm, is in charge of operations at Lifts Risa, in Stoughton, Wisconsin. Fantastic place. He helped create this heritage center back in 2011, and I'm going to certainly hear the story about that. Jerry, welcome. Thanks for joining in today.
Yes, happy to be here.
Also with us, with a big smile on her face, Dana Kelly is the executive director of the Norwegian American Genealogical Center, and it is based in Madison. Dana has a degree in Scandinavian studies from UW-Madison and can speak, read, and write in Norwegian. Dana, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having us. Great to be here.
Well, it's going to be a lot of fun talking about this history. And as we talk with them and you're listening in, I hope you'll join in. Want to hear from you. Let us know how you're celebrating, maybe sitting a mai. Tell us the story of how your family came to America, maybe. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Coming up on Saturday is Sitting a Mai. I have a special fondness for Sitting a Mai because I was born in Stoughton, and our family has a lot of ties to Stoughton, and my mother won a microwave oven in a drawing that was held on Sitting a Mai. And I think it was our first one, our first microwave oven. So anyway, so that's what it kind of means to me a little bit. What does this holiday mean to Norwegians?
What does a holiday mean to Norwegian? It's about the same as our July 4th. It's their Independence Day, and we in the U.S. With the English, obviously, had a war with them to get independent. Well, the Norwegians didn't have a war. They had wars. And their getting independent was not a matter of saying to the Swedes, we want independence, because at times both the Swedes and the Norwegians were part of Denmark and part of and the Church of Germany was in it, France was in it, but Norway had tried and tried and couldn't gain independence. And finally, the story is that Denmark gave Norway to Sweden because they couldn't do anything with the Norwegians. And I think over time, I think the Swedes came to the same conclusion as the Danes and finally gave Norway its independence. And 1825 is their significant day, just like our July 4th, 1776 is. But 1825 is the big day, and they celebrate it just like we celebrate July 4th, only they have a bigger celebration than we do with July 4th. We have a far bigger celebration in Stoughton because of Sitting a Mai than we do with July 4th.
Yeah, it's been, and it runs from the 16th through the 18th this year, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you, just ask you both this question, and maybe start with you, Dana. How did you find a passion for studying Norwegian culture and language?
I grew up in Deerfield, which is a Norwegian-American community.
I grew up in Cottage Grove.
Oh,
so.
Well, there you go. Neighbors. Yeah, so it was, you know, when you're the fish, you don't notice the water.
Yeah.
Everybody was Norwegian in our neighborhood. Everybody, Stoughton was the big city we'd go to McDonald's or Pizza Hut. Everybody was Norwegian. And I actually fell in love with genealogy before I fell in love with Norwegian heritage specifically. In middle school, I started researching my family, and I detected that the majority of my ancestors were Norwegian. So then when I got to college, they asked me, you know, do you want to continue with Spanish? You need more Spanish to graduate anyway. And I said, well, definitely not. I don't want to do any more Spanish. And they said, well, what language do you want to learn then? And I said, do you have Norwegian? And they said, well, yeah, we can get you in Norwegian. Apparently, there's not much of a demand. So I took Norwegian for 3 years. And by then, I was halfway to a Scandinavian Studies degree. So I said, well, I might as well finish. Might as well get a major in Scandinavian Studies. And everybody made fun of that decision. They said, what are you going to do with that degree? And I didn't have a very good answer until 6 years ago when they called me and said, we're looking for a new director for the Norwegian American Genealogical Center. And so for the past 6 years, I've been the one laughing. I got to be a professional Norwegian, and they said I'd never get to do it.
Jerry, what about you?
Yeah. Nope, I don't speak Norwegian. I have enough trouble with English. And the reason I say Norwegian is in my background that I worked all over the world. England, France, Germany, Poland, Austria, Brazil, China, Japan, Korea, Malaysia, Mexico. And what I found early on was me trying to communicate in their language was the wrong thing to do. What I did was I searched out individuals that I would be working with that were very fluent in English. And I found the same thing in Norway, that in Norway, the second language, almost the first language today, is English.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter where I go in Norway. I don't have any trouble speaking with people, especially the young people, because it's a required classes in school is English.
Yeah.
And what I found interesting was with the immigrants that come from different parts of the world, they get a lot of them from the Middle East, India, Pakistan, those countries. And when they come into Norway, if they have children, the children don't go to a Norwegian school. The children go to an international school. And in the international school, they don't learn Norwegian. The first thing they do is they teach them English, because evidently English is a little bit easier to learn than Norwegian. So when they become proficient in English, then they move them on to the Norwegian schools. So everybody that is in the schools speaks English and Norwegian, and so do the immigrants.
Yeah. Tom Loftus mentioned that. He said they don't even call it a second language. It's your other language that you have to learn, English. So
I was walking once in Oslo. They gave me a tour, and I'm walking with this older gentleman, and we're trying to communicate because some of the older gentlemen, people, aren't as fluent in English.
Mm-hmm.
And we're walking down the street, and he looks over at me, and he says, Jerry, you should learn more Norwegian. And I looked over at him, and I says, yes, but you should learn more English.
Well, the Stoughton has a special connection with its Norwegian heritage. A lot of Norwegians, I guess, must have emigrated. In fact, Tom even mentioned that a little bit in passing, that Stoughton was an area where a lot of people landed.
Yeah. What we call the Koshkonong Prairie. It's the southeast portion of Dane County, some into Jefferson County, some into Rock County. But the immigrants came there. Some of them had to work for other immigrants to begin with. Some of them came with skills that they could do things, whether they're carpenters or teachers or even clergy. And so when they came, They settled in that Kashkanan Prairie, and that's what Lift's Rice started out as. Our goal was not to learn about Norwegian history, but more about the immigration that came from Norway during the early middle 1800s. And that's our focus also today, that most of the stories that we have to tell in Lift's Rice are about actual Norwegian immigrants at the time. And some struggled, some prospered, some went back to Norway, and some moved on to Washington on the Pacific coast.
Well, I want to get more into that, but I want to get Dana involved on the... You're executive director of the Norwegian American Genealogical Center. What kind of work do you do at the center?
We have a library. So if you want to come in and do some genealogical research, learn more about Norwegian American communities here in the United States, we have a lot of, we have about 12,000 items on our shelves that are about that particular subject. We also offer classes. So if you're not sure how to get started with your genealogy, you can take some classes with us. We have Norwegian language classes, too. Every Wednesday and Thursday morning, we have students in our conference room learning Norwegian language. And we also have services, too. So if you have a pile of letters in your closet or a diary or something that's in Norwegian and you'd like it translated to English, that's the type of thing.
You can do that.
Yeah, we can take a look at that. We also do the research for you. So if you get started and say, you know what, this is not for me, but I sure would like to have the answer at the end of the journey, we have researchers who can do the research for you if you're interested in that.
Luke in Central Wisconsin has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Luke.
Hey, Larry. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
As always, a very interesting show.
Thank you.
I thought I heard you guys talking about it might be the Norwegian Independence Day or close to.
Yeah.
I was wondering if your lady guest, I forget her name, I'm sorry, if she could maybe recite, if they have an anthem like the United States does, if she could recite that in Norwegian, I thought that'd be cool.
That's called Javielsker.
Javielsker. Yeah. Okay. I don't know if I can say it. I may have to sing it.
Well, go ahead.
Because I don't know if I can get all the words.
Sing it. Sing it for us, Dana.
This was not an expected question, so I did not prepare for that. So, but let's see here. It goes, Ja, vi elsker dette landet som det stiger frem. Før det var blitt overvannet med de tusen hjem. Elsker, elsker deg og tenker på vår far og mor. Og den saga natt som senker drømmer på vår jord. Og den saga natt som senker, senker drømmer på vår jord.
Wow! Wow.
That was really, really good.
That was really, really good.
Well, thank you. I started a little too high, but that's okay. Close enough. You got the idea. And well, I think I got all the words.
And it's got that kind of regal, sound that you expect from a kind of a national anthem. Too.
Yeah. And I think it's easier than ours. Easier to sing.
Yeah. Yes.
Ours is hard.
How many thousands times have we sung it? And I always... it's hard to sing ours. So the meaning, of course, is we're proud Norwegians and we're...
Yeah, it was a poem that was set, just like our national anthem. It was originally a poem that was set to music, and that's just one verse. I think there's 10 verses to
oh
their that poem, and that's the only one I know. Don't ask for any more. But yeah, the first line is "Yes, we love this land,"
yeah,
and it's about loving their country and
yeah,
and being connected to the land. Yeah.
Dana Kelly is executive director of the Norwegian American Genealogical Center based in Madison. Jerry Grittenholm is in charge of operations at Livsreisa. I don't know. I said that many, many times before the show, and I said it right most every time. And, of course, now when I get on the air, I can't say it right. Livsreisa. In Stoughton, and we're going to learn some more about that. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we take a look at how Norwegian heritage is thriving in Wisconsin with our two guests, Dana Kelly, Executive Director of the Norwegian American Genealogical Center based in Madison, and Jerry Grittenholm is in charge of operations at Livsreisa in Stoughton, Wisconsin. It's a really cool thing. We're going to learn some more about that as we move along. You can join in. Questions or comments, maybe an experience to share. I hope you will join in. Number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Jerry, let's talk about Livsreisa for a few minutes here. What does Livsreisa mean, by the way?
It means life's journey. Livsreisa is not a word in Norwegian. We didn't want to call it the Stoughton Norwegian Heritage Center or something like that, so the zebra dog who we were working with the design for the programs and that came up with an idea, we'll invent the word. So the word that they invented was Livsreisa, and it means life's journey.
That's very cool. And the structure, what are people going to see if they come to Stoughton?
One of the things that we decided early on was that we did not want to be a museum, that we wanted it to be about people and immigration. So with the help of Zebra Dog, who is kind of out of the box kind of a company in terms of doing development programs, that we worked with them, and where they suggested things that we can do this with a picture, we can do that with a picture, and my idea was, if we can do this with a picture, why can't we do this with a computer? We can do so much more. So the whole of the interior, we have Norwegian culture, whether it's dance, music, arts, mythology, presentations that we've made that we wanted to keep, and we have actual stories from individuals that had ancestors in the Kashkanan Prairie, and we have what we call the Plan Your Journey, where you can, it's all computerized, and it's a 33-section screen that's absolutely huge.
Yeah.
But you can do a minor program to tell whether you want to come by boat or steamboat, or if you had a hobby or a work or different aspects of your life, and you would do the panel, and it would develop a journey for you. And the journey would take you from someplace in Norway and a whole trip to the ocean, sometimes to England, across the ocean to Boston, New York, or Chicago, Milwaukee, and then from those locations, then you'd be on your own, and you'd be in soon the Kashkanan Prairie.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of these people that came had nothing but a trunk or some of them, as they said, by the time they got to the Koshkonong Prairie, had little more than the clothes on their back. So what was, I think, great about the Norwegian immigration for those that came as time went on was how the original people, Norwegians that came, took in the new immigrants, helped them along, and got them on their way. And like I said a little earlier, the Koshkonong Prairie is where our focus is. But a lot of the Norwegians moved on, to Minnesota, North and South Dakota, all the way out to the state of Washington. They probably would have gone farther, but they didn't have a boat.
So ran out of land.
Well, someone right. to Alaska.
Yeah. So yeah, they went up. They went north. Well, this Lift Rice building is absolutely fantastic. Dana, you've been there.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, we were fortunate at the Bryant Foundation that Janet Bryant, who was really the benefactor for the Bryant Foundation, left all of her money, left her estate to the Bryant Foundation. And we wanted to do something that would be lasting forever for Janet Bryant. And what we came up with was the Heritage Center. Now, I maybe asked too many questions about it, and pretty soon I was in charge of it.
That often happens in life.
But not knowing what to do, I set out to educate myself, and I went to different Norwegian settlements that are already in the area, up at Norskadalen, up in Coon Valley, over the Giants of the Earth, over in Spring Grove, Minnesota. One of the big ones I got to was Vesterheim in Decorah, Iowa.
Yeah, well, that's a big one.
Yeah, and I even went to the Swiss Center in New Glarus, Wisconsin, and I went to the Italian Center in Milwaukee, and all to kind of educate myself on, you know, what are other people doing. But I think the biggest thing I learned was, what would they do if they could do it over? Mm. How would they change it? And that, I think, was the bigger part of my education, was things I should avoid that they did that now they can't change. So,
well, it is a fantastic facility. It's just beautiful facility. And, you know, it's kind of unlike Oslo now. Oslo is kind of a gleaming, all glass operation anymore.
That was one of my primary focuses, because I had been to Norway and Oslo and Bergen. And what I didn't want it to look like a log cabin.
Yeah.
I didn't want it to look like the glass and steel structures in Oslo. I wanted something more moderate, and the moderate was Bergen. And the riverfront, oceanfront in Bergen. And their building is kind of a takeoff on that. And how did I get the approval to do that? Well, I went to a design firm, architects in Cedarburg, and because I learned from them from Vesterheim, and said this, showed up, didn't have an appointment, showed up and sat down with these people, and I think they thought I was kind of nuts, but got them to understand what we wanted to do. And so they went to work and did this design, and they took it to the board, and the board said, no, we aren't going to do this. This is too expensive. So, okay, I went back to the architectural firm, and I says, tone it down and way down. So I come back to the board, and the board says, we don't like this neither. Go build the building. So we were able to go back to the art deck and tell them to go ahead and do it, and that we would fund the building. but the building had to be of a nature that it like I said, not Oslo, not log cabin, moderate, but it had to be a forever building. We wanted it to be old immigrant, but it had to be a forever building, and that's what we have.
And that's what you do have. It's an exciting structure when you walk into it. The main area where people are going to be viewing things is enormous. High ceilings, beautiful structure inside and out, that matter. Paul in Hurley has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was fortunate enough to visit relatives over in Scotland 3 summers ago out on the Orkney Islands. So I had Ancestry.com done to see what my percentage was of Scottish, and I found out I had more Norwegian in me than Scottish. So when did the Orkneys switch over to being Scottish?
Your ancestors must have run into to the Vikings. They traveled around a lot.
Dana, you got anything for Paul on that too?
The Orkneys were part of Norway, and I don't remember. It's been hundreds of years, but their language in the Orkneys is very heavily influenced by Scandinavian languages. So I'm not surprised if your heritage. If your ancestors were on those islands for many generations, they probably came from Norway first. Icelanders, too, they often, their DNA, when they take a test, often shows that they're Norwegian, not Icelandic, because that's the same population settled both of those places. So I can't say I'm surprised. But yeah, that was part of Norway, I want to say, till about 700 years ago. So, but don't quote me on that. That's just my recollection.
Oh, Paul, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Doug emailed us wondering if you could talk about the 1852 Hauge Historic District Park in the town of Perry, west of Madison in Dane County. It has the original 1852 Norwegian log church on it, the original Norwegian cemetery, and 3 miles of hiking trails. There's a handicapped restroom, and a park has a fantastic view with the second highest public observation point in Dane County, and that's the Hauge Historic District Park.
I know nothing about that.
Okay, well, I can take some of this here. So the Haugians, that was a dissenting group of Lutherans in Norway in the early 1800s. There was a movement founded by Hans Nielsen Hauge, and he was a lay preacher. And at that time in Norway, it was illegal to preach Christianity if you were not officially ordained by the Lutheran Church. And he did some time in jail, but that didn't deter him. And his movement spread, especially in the western part of Norway and those rural communities there. And a lot of them, when they immigrated to this country, brought that less formal religious belief with them. And they founded a few different Haugian congregations. There used to be one in Deerfield where right along Highway 12 and 18 between Deerfield and Cambridge. The cemetery's still there, but that church is gone. But yes, there was one out in Perry, too, that were those less formal, less highbrow Lutheran churches where it was part of their belief system was that everybody should be able to lead a Bible study if they were familiar with the contents of the Bible. So that was what that church was all about. It was more of like church of the people kind of church. And yeah, thankfully that old church has been preserved. It's one of it's probably the oldest Haugian church left in the United States, I would guess. I don't know that for sure, but as old as it is, I think it probably is the oldest one.
So the tradition, I mean, that's a tradition, not really a tradition, sort of an anti-tradition. What were the traditions, maybe you could both comment on this, some of the traditions that the Norwegians brought with them from Norway to Wisconsin?
Well, part of what we understand with that was they were very caring people, and when the immigrants came, that the ones before them, or even the farm communities, rural communities, opened their arms up to these new immigrants, because if you go back far enough, they all came for the same reason. They came because they wanted a better life. There were many, many reasons why a lot of people in Norway will never have a better life. And I think a good example of that is that if you grew up on a farm, and say there's five children, the way the rules were was that eventually when Ma and Pa had to pass on, that the oldest in the family got the farm. Now, what happens with the other four? Yeah. If you were a female, you had to probably marry somebody that was going to inherit a farm. But the males, they had nothing, so they came to America.
And the interesting thing was, and Tom Loftus mentioned this too, the immigrants brought what they learned farming. They came here to be farmers or whatever, you know, whatever profession they had, but a lot of them came to be farmers. So I can tell you one thing they brought, and I have had the opportunity at many a Lutheran church in our area to partake of lutefisk and lefse.
Lutefisk is, you know, really a dried cod, and that fishermen, when they went out on the ocean to do the fishing, they couldn't take fresh food with them because they'd be gone for a long time. So they had this salted cod. And to make it edible, in Stoughton anyways, that you'd put it in a lye barrel and you had to soak it and soak it and soak it, and you could make a nice meal out of it. But you could also make a terrible meal out of it.
Yeah.
If you cooked it too much, it turned to jelly. I grew up with lutefisk, and I've had good lutefisk, and I've had not so good. But the lefse, you can't destroy lefse.
You can't destroy, especially you put a little cinnamon and butter on it. That was my experience, too. Jerry, there were some good ones, and then there were some that were, you kind of knew when you walked through the doors what it was going to be like by the aromas that were emanating from the kitchen area. And some of them were pretty darn good, and some of them were, I am going to concentrate on the lefse this time and take a small amount of the lutefisk just to be polite.
Yeah. Well, and a family tradition was we had lutefisk and lefse every Christmas. And the best thing that happened with the lutefisk at Christmas was that my older brother took over cooking the lutefisk and got my mother out of cooking lutefisk. Then lutefisk got to be okay.
Oh, man. So lutefisk and lefse for sure. I don't know how many lutefisk dinners we went to at various churches around Cottage Grove. I think we were in Deerfield, too, for one or two. I guess part of it, even if the food wasn't good, the conversations...
It was always good.
The conversations were always good. You know what? We're going to take a reminder, give you a little reminder here that our guests today are Dana Kelly and Jerry Grentenholm. We're talking with them about Norwegian culture and history. Here's Sit and Amai coming up this weekend. It seems like a perfect time to be doing it and a perfect time for you to be listening to WPR News. Talking about Norwegian heritage. It's still thriving in Wisconsin with our two guests, Dana Kelly from the Norwegian American Geological Center based in Madison, and Jerry Grittenholm, who is in charge of operations at Lifsrisa in Stoughton. Great to have them along. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234. We have a Wisconsin Life piece recording that I think fits perfectly into the show. You're going to hear from McKenna Shearer. McKenna shared a story she called the largest gathering of Norwegians in northwestern Wisconsin, probably, she says, Geary Fest. She told it at a live storytelling event hosted by WPR's Wisconsin Life and Chippewa Valley Writers Guild. It was held November 14th, 2024, in Eau Claire at the Lakely. Let's hear it.
About 150 years ago, a couple of Norwegians, Sivert Geary and Ingeborg Male, emigrated from Norway to the United States, and by 1920 had settled with their family in Dunn County. Sivert and Ingeborg had 4 sons and 2 daughters. From then on, you know how it goes, those kids got married and had kids of their own, and the cycle repeated until it got to my dad. He met a gal with a big laugh and a bigger heart, my mom, and in 2000, yours truly popped out. Well, I'm pleased to report that 150 years later, the Gearys are now, and maybe always have been, a bunch of loudmouth Norwegians. I think they taught me my first curse word, and my family knows how much I love those. It's cackling women who showed me I never needed to be silent or make myself small, and the quieter Geary men who have always worked with their hands and loved their family. But a room can get pretty stuffy when it's filled with a family as big as ours, so the Gearys started having family get-togethers outdoors. One of those first planned family reunions was called Geary Fest. For the past near 20 years, my great-aunt Jayette and great-uncle Larry Geary have been hosting that family reunion at their Dunn County homestead. Annually, they welcome 70-plus loud-mouth family members for Labor Day weekend when Geary Fest is held. In my 24 years, I don't remember ever missing 1 year of Geary Fest. Through rain and humidity, Gearys show up. I think that kind of commitment to Geary Fest is because of 3 things. There are 2 Midwestern potluck-style meals in 1 day. Hey. The Hestisco tournament, and because Great Aunt Jayette said so. And I'm sure most of you are curious, what's Hestisco? Hestisco translates from Norwegian to English as horseshoes, the game. Traditionally, people play horseshoes with horseshoes. Gearys don't do that. We use washers. And no, I've never won. My dad has, though, twice, so it's in my blood. Nowadays, my favorite part of the reunion is the silent auction. Every family that comes aims to bring at least 1 thing for it, and the money raised goes right back to the Geary Fund. Those funds cover the cost of hosting Geary Fest, but it's also a family fund. We've donated to family members with cancer. We've given money to members to go on mission trips. And my great-uncle Larry added, don't forget about the headstones. Headstones? The whole reason Geary Fest even exists is because of those Norwegians who emigrated to America 150 years ago. But for a long time, the family didn't even know who was all part of our family tree. Great Aunt Jayette came across a headstone one day while visiting a Dunn County cemetery, and all it contained was 3 words. Mother, Father, Geary. When she asked my great uncle Larry, who was laid to rest there, he said, well, I don't know, men. So for the past couple of decades, Great Aunt Jayette has made it her mission to not only identify the names of our Geary ancestors, but also to get to know them. She has so many stories of poring over archives of publications that no longer exist, through marriage certificates, and she's even stumbled across a couple of vintage wares at thrift sales that had the name Geary written on them. Frankly, I haven't appreciated all of that work and all of that history until recently, but I should have. I don't know who I would be if I didn't grow up in Wisconsin, and I don't know who I would be without the Gearys. I don't think I'd be a loudmouth, cursing, hardworking woman if I didn't spend every Labor Day weekend at Geary Fest. But I do know one thing. For the Gearys, Ufta means family. Thank you.
Oh, very nice. You can catch Wisconsin Life Stories, by the way, on WPR News and WPR Music every Wednesday and Friday and online at any time on wisconsinlife.org. So, Dana, I'll turn to you because a lot of it had to do with genealogy in a way. What'd you think?
Yeah, it's a cute story, but the whole time I'm dying to know how Geary is spelled because I'm guessing that in Norway it wasn't pronounced that way.
It was, it was, I think, spelled, well, G-I-E-R-E.
Okay.
But it also might have been I can't imagine it was G-E-A-R. G-I-E-R-E.
Probably not, yeah. Yeah, it was probably, a name of a farm in Norway that the family chose to use for a last name when they got here.
Is that how it worked? You got to choose your own name when you got here?
Well,
pretty much.
Yep, I think my father's side kept the name because I've been to the Grittenholm farm in Lena, Norway, which is by Jovik, which is our Stoughton sister city. So I've been there. I have the sheet that's about 3 feet wide and 4 feet long of the history of the family all the way back to the 1400s.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, and I'm still looking for myself.
Do you ever work with Dana on this or somebody?
Well, I was going to bring up that... Dana and I's relationship is that we're integral to each other's programs. When we did the Lifts Risa, that one of the things that we have in there is we have a genealogy center, but ours is education, hers is research and education. So we work together. And we, in our genealogy center, we have direct access to the NACES programs, which helps us tremendously from a space standpoint. And if somebody wants additional information, again, they just contact the NACES library. But we do genealogy there, too. But we're not a research organization. We're more of the education.
Yeah. Skip and Milton has something for us, maybe along a different line, but maybe not. Let's go there. Skip, hi.
Hi. Great show. I'm switching gears a little bit there is an American Birkebeiner up in from Cable to Hayward every year. It's a world lappet race. Each country can only have one world lappet, and the World Lappet for Wisconsin, for the United States, is right here in Wisconsin, but it's patterned after the Norwegian Birkebeiner, which started 97 years ago or so, or close to 100. But that was the Norwegian Birkebeiner goes over the same route that Prince Haakon was rescued by the two Birkebeiners. That Birke is Norwegian for birch bark or birch, and they had birch bark leggings to keep the snow out. They carried that prince, the two-year-old prince, up over the mountain, and that's where the Norwegian Birkebeiner goes, over a good-sized climb up the mountain and down the other side, 55 kilometers, 34 miles, and they rescued the prince. He likely would have died had that not happened.
Had that not happened. And you guys are familiar with that story, I'm pretty sure, Dana?
Yes, that's a pretty popular legend.
We look at the Birkebeiner over here because they have it in northern Wisconsin, but there's a big difference. The Birkebeiner in Wisconsin is pretty much flatlanders. In Norway, it's real people, because it is very difficult, and so
Yeah, the hills are bigger.
Yes, they are.
In Norway than they are here, but it's still a pretty darn tough. I haven't done it, I'll say that, but I have lots of friends who have done the Berkey.
Yeah.
And it's still pretty grueling, probably for us Wisconsinites.
Yeah. Principle is the same.
Right.
the principle is definitely the same. Skip, thanks so much for calling. So how does learning about your ancestry add to your life?
Well, it changed mine.
Yeah, sure did.
For sure. I mean, that was a turning point. For sure. Who knows what I would be if it hadn't been for genealogy. I don't know.
Well, it's probably a little the same for you, Jerry.
I think the big thing is learning the history and what our grandparents and those before them came is, don't tell me about how hard you've got it. Don't tell me about that, because you're not going to get any sympathy. and I've drilled that into our children, and it becomes a principle with the grandchildren too, that nothing is going to be handed to you. You got to work for it.
Dana, here's an email for you, I think. Why is Norwegian geography an important part of genealogy research?
It is pretty important because Norwegians didn't have inherited surnames. So up until about 100 years ago.
Yeah.
That was not required. So their naming tradition was they had a first name, you know, like Lars or Mikkel or Ingeborg. And they would have a patronymic name. So if their father was named Knut, the sons would be Knutsen, the daughters would be Knut's daughter. And so children didn't have the same last name as their parents, unless their grandfather happened to also be Knut. If their dad was Knut Knutsen, well, then they did have the same name as their father. But it could change with every generation. And having the same patronymic name as somebody else didn't necessarily mean you were related. It just means that both of your dads were named Knut. That's all that really meant. And the last part of their name, which was more of an address. It was very common for Norwegians, if they were living on a farm, they would assume the name of the farm as their last name. So if you were living on the Grittenholm farm, you would use that like it was a last name. So you might be Lars Knutsen Grittenholm. But if you moved to the Berg farm, you would become Lars Knutsen Berg. And it didn't mean you owned the farm. It just meant you lived there. And you may have a dozen farm names in a lifetime. So knowing where your ancestors came from is really important, because you can't just go looking for Ole Olsen. You'll find one. I promise. You will find one. But it might not be your Ole Olsen. So that geography is really, really, really important to help us narrow down which Ole Olsen is your Ole Olsen.
You ever run out of work?
Not yet.
Are there ever people that... I wonder where everybody went to. We don't have anybody coming anymore. That doesn't happen.
I started a company, sales engineering company in Frankfurt, West Germany. Yeah. And one day after I was all finished with my work, and I decided I needed supper, so I go to the hotel restaurant, and the waiter struck up conversation with me and wanted to know what my name was. And I told him it was Grittenholm. And he says, that's German. I says, no, that's Norwegian. He says, no, I'm a genealogist. That's German.
It sounds Swedish to me, no offense. Yeah.
On that happy note, sit the mice this weekend, the 16th through the 18th. And visit, while you're there, visit Livsrisa. I'm sure it's open, and it's a chance to go in and see this wonderful facility. And it's great to talk. Dana Kelly, Executive Director of Norwegian American Genealogical Center, and Jerry Grittenholm, Norwegian for sure, yes, is in charge of operations at Livsrisa. It's great to have them with us. And thank you so much for joining in today as well. Of course, our producers, Claire Kniper, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, our technical directors. I'm Larry Mueller, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.